Side 2. The Autobiography of Malcolm X. Continuing on page 31. Anyway, from my experience as a little boy at the Lansing School, I'd become fairly adept at avoiding the white girl issue, at least for a couple of years yet. Then in the second semester of the seventh grade, I was elected class president. It surprised me even more than other people. But I can see now why the class might have done it. My grades were among the highest in the school. I was unique in my class, like a pink poodle. And I was proud. I'm not going to say I wasn't. In fact, by then I didn't really have much feeling about being a Negro because I was trying so hard in every way I could to be white. Which is why I'm spending much of my life today telling the American black man that he's wasting his time straining to integrate. I know from personal experience. I tried hard enough. Malcolm, we're just so proud of you, Mrs. Swerlin exclaimed when she heard about my election. It was all over the restaurant where I worked. Even the state man, Maynard Allen, who still dropped by to see me once in a while, had a word of praise. He said he never saw anybody prove better exactly what reform meant. I really liked him, except for one thing. He now and then would drop something that hinted my mother had let us down somehow. Fairly often I would go and visit the Lions, and they acted as happy as though I was one of their children. And it was the same warm feeling when I went into Lansing to visit my brothers and sisters and the Gohannas. I remember one thing that marred this time for me, the movie Gone with the Wind. When it played in Mason, I was the only Negro in the theater, and when Butterfly McQueen went into her act, I felt like crawling under the rug. Every Saturday, just about, I would go into Lansing. I was going on 14 now. Wilfred and Hilda still lived out by themselves at the old family home. Hilda kept the house very clean. It was easier than my mother's plight, with eight of us always underfoot or running around. Wilfred worked wherever he could, and he still read every book he could get his hands on. Philbert was getting a reputation as one of the better amateur fighters in this part of the state. Everyone really expected that he was going to become a professional. Reginald and I, after my fighting fiasco, had finally gotten back on good terms. It made me feel great to visit him and Wesley over at Mrs. Williams. I'd offhandedly give them each a couple of dollars to just stick in their pockets to have something to spend. And little Yvonne and Robert were doing okay, too, over at the home of the West Indian lady, Mrs. McGuire. I'd give them about a quarter apiece. It made me feel good to see how they were coming along. None of us talked much about our mother, and we never mentioned our father. I guess none of us knew what to say. We didn't want anybody else to mention our mother either, I think. From time to time, though, we would all go over to Kalamazoo to visit her. Most often we older ones went singly, for it was something you didn't want to have to experience with anyone else present, even your brother or sister. During this period, the visit to my mother that I most remember was toward the end of that seventh grade year, when our father's grown daughter by his first marriage, Ella, came from Boston to visit us. Wilfred and Hilda had exchanged some letters with Ella, and I, at Hilda's suggestion, had written to her from the Swerlins. We were all excited and happy when her letter told us that she was coming to Lansing. I think the major impact of Ella's arrival, at least upon me, was that she was the first really proud black woman I'd ever seen in my life. She was plainly proud of her very dark skin. This was unheard of among Negroes in those days, especially in Lansing. I hadn't been sure just what day she would come, and then one afternoon I got home from school and there she was. She hugged me, stood me away, looked me up and down. A commanding woman, maybe even bigger than Mrs. Swerlin. Ella wasn't just black, but like our father, she was jet black. The way she sat, moved, talked, did everything, bespoke somebody who did and got exactly what she wanted. This was the woman my father had boasted of so often for having brought so many of their family out of Georgia to Boston. She owned some property, he would say, and she was in society. She'd come north with nothing, and she'd worked and saved and had invested in property that she built up in value. And then she started sending money to Georgia for another sister, brother, cousin, niece, or nephew to come north to Boston. All that I'd heard was reflected in Ella's appearance and bearing. I had never been so impressed with anybody. She was in her second marriage. Her first husband had been a doctor. Ella asked all kinds of questions about how I was doing. She'd already heard from Wilfred and Hilda about my election as class president. She asked especially about my grades, and I ran and got my report cards. I was then one of the three highest in the class. Ella praised me. I asked her about her brother, Earl, and her sister, Mary. She had the exciting news that Earl was a singer with a band in Boston. He was singing under the name of Jimmy Carlton. Mary was also doing well. Ella told me about other relatives from that branch of the family, a number of them I'd never heard of. She'd helped them up from Georgia. They, in their turn, had helped up others. "We littles have to stick together," Ella said. It thrilled me to hear her say that, and even more the way she said it. I'd become a mascot. Our branch of the family was split to pieces. I'd just about forgotten about being a little in any family sense. She said the different members of the family were working in good jobs, and some even had small businesses going. Most of them were homeowners. When Ella suggested that all of us littles in Lansing accompany her on a visit to our mother, we all were grateful. We all felt that if anyone could do anything that could help our mother, that might help her get well and come back, it would be Ella. Anyway, all of us, for the first time together, went with Ella to Kalamazoo. Our mother was smiling when they brought her out. She was extremely surprised when she saw Ella. They made a striking contrast, the thin, near-white woman and the big black one hugging each other. I don't remember much about the rest of the visit, except that there was a lot of talking, and Ella had everything in hand, and we left with all of us feeling better than we ever had about the circumstances. I know that for the first time, I felt as though I had visited with someone who had some kind of physical illness that had just lingered on. A few days later, after visiting the homes where each of us was staying, Ella left Lansing and returned to Boston. But before leaving, she told me to write to her regularly, and she'd suggested that I might like to spend my summer holiday visiting her in Boston. I jumped at that chance. That summer of 1940 in Lansing, I caught the Greyhound bus for Boston with my cardboard suitcase and wearing my green suit. If someone had hung a sign, "Hick," around my neck, I couldn't have looked much more obvious. They didn't have the turnpikes then. The bus stopped at what seemed every corner and cowpatch. From my seat in, you guessed it, the back of the bus, I gawked out of the window at white man's America rolling past for what seemed a month, but must have been only a day and a half. When we finally arrived, Ella met me at the terminal and took me home. The house was on Waumbeck Street in the Sugar Hill section of Roxbury, the Harlem of Boston. I met Ella's second husband, Frank, who was now a soldier, and her brother Earl, the singer who called himself Jimmy Carlton, and Mary, who was very different from her older sister. It's funny how I seem to think of Mary as Ella's sister instead of her being just as Ella is, my own half-sister. It's probably because Ella and I always were much closer as basic types. We're dominant people, and Mary has always been mild and quiet, almost shy. Ella was busily involved in dozens of things. She belonged to I don't know how many different clubs. She was a leading light of local so-called black society. I saw and met 100 black people there whose big city talk and ways left my mouth hanging open. I couldn't have feigned indifference if I'd tried to. People talked casually about Chicago, Detroit, New York. I didn't know the world contained as many Negroes as I saw thronging downtown Roxbury at night, especially on Saturdays. Neon lights, nightclubs, pool halls, bars, the cars they drove. Restaurants made the streets smell. Rich, greasy, down-home black cooking. Jukeboxes blared Erskine Hawkins, Duke Ellington, Cootie Williams, dozens of others. If somebody had told me then that someday I'd know them all personally, I'd have found it hard to believe. The biggest bands like these played at the Roseland State Ballroom on Boston's Massachusetts Avenue. One night for Negroes, the next night for whites. I saw for the first time occasional black-white couples strolling around arm in arm, and on Sundays when Ella, Mary, or somebody took me to church, I saw churches for black people such as I'd never seen. They were many times finer than the white church I'd attended back in Mason, Michigan. There the white people just sat and worshipped with words, but the Boston Negroes, like all other Negroes I'd ever seen at church, threw their souls and bodies wholly into worship. Two or three times I wrote letters to Wilfred intended for everybody back in Lansing. I said I'd try to describe it when I got back. But I found I couldn't. My restlessness with Mason, and for the first time in my life a restlessness with being around white people, began as soon as I got back home and entered the eighth grade. I continued to think constantly about all that I'd seen in Boston, and about the way I'd felt there. I knew now that it was the sense of being a real part of a mass of my own kind for the first time. The white people, classmates, the Swirlins, the people at the restaurant where I worked, noticed the change. They said, "You're acting so strange. You don't seem like yourself, Malcolm. What's the matter?" I kept close to the top of the class, though. The topmost scholastic standing, I remember, kept shifting between me, a girl named Audrey Slaw, and a boy named Jimmy Cotton. It went on that way, as I became increasingly restless and disturbed through the first semester. And then one day, just about when those of us who had passed were about to move up to 8A, from which we would enter high school the next year, something happened which was to become the first major turning point of my life. Somehow, I happened to be alone in the classroom with Mr. Ostrowski, my English teacher. He was a tall, rather reddish-white man, and he had a thick mustache. I'd gotten some of my best marks under him, and he had always made me feel that he liked me. He was, as I've mentioned, a natural-born advisor about what you ought to read, to do, or think, about any and everything. We used to make unkind jokes about him. Why was he teaching in Mason instead of somewhere else, getting for himself some of the success in life that he kept telling us how to get? I know that he probably meant well in what he happened to advise me that day. I doubt that he meant any harm. It was just in his nature as an American white man. I was one of his top students, one of the school's top students. But all he could see for me was the kind of future in your place that almost all white people see for black people. He told me, "Malcolm, you ought to be thinking about a career. Have you been giving it thought?" The truth is, I hadn't. I never have figured out why I told him, "Well, yes, sir. I've been thinking I'd like to be a lawyer." Lansing certainly had no Negro lawyers, or doctors either in those days, to hold up an image I might have aspired to. All I really knew for certain was that a lawyer didn't wash dishes, as I was doing. Mr. Ostrowski looked surprised, I remember, and leaned back in his chair and clasped his hands behind his head. He kind of half-smiled and said, "Malcolm, one of life's first needs is for us to be realistic. Don't misunderstand me now. We all here like you. You know that. But you've got to be realistic about being a nigger. A lawyer? That's no realistic goal for a nigger. You need to think about something you can be. You're good with your hands, making things. Everybody admires your carpentry shop work. Why don't you plan on carpentry? People like you as a person. You'd get all kinds of work." The more I thought afterwards about what he said, the more uneasy it made me. It just kept treading around in my mind. What made it really begin to disturb me was Mr. Ostrowski's advice to others in my class, all of them white. Most of them had told them they were planning to become farmers. But those who wanted to strike out on their own, to try something new, he had encouraged. Some, mostly girls, wanted to be teachers. A few wanted other professions, such as one boy wanted to become a county agent, another a veterinarian, and one girl wanted to be a nurse. They all reported that Mr. Ostrowski had encouraged what they had wanted. Yet nearly none of them had earned marks equal to mine. It was a surprising thing that I had never thought of it that way before. But I realized that whatever I wasn't, I was smarter than nearly all of those white kids. But apparently I was still not intelligent enough in their eyes to become whatever I wanted to be. It was then that I began to change. Inside. I drew away from white people. I came to class and I answered when called upon. It became a physical strain simply to sit in Mr. Ostrowski's class. Where "nigger" had slipped off my back before, wherever I heard it now, I stopped and looked at whoever said it, and they looked surprised that I did. I quit hearing so much "nigger" and "what's wrong," which was the way I wanted it. Nobody, including the teachers, could decide what had come over me. I knew I was being discussed. In a few more weeks, it was that way, too, at the restaurant where I worked washing dishes, and at the Swirlin's. One day soon after, Mrs. Swirlin called me into the living room, and there was the state man, Maynard Allen. I knew from their faces that something was about to happen. She told me that none of them could understand why, after I'd done so well in school and on my job and living with them, and after everyone in Mason had come to like me, I had lately begun to make them all feel that I wasn't happy there anymore. She said she felt there was no need for me to stay at the detention home any longer, and that arrangements had been made for me to go and live with the Lyons family, who liked me so much. She stood up and put out her hand. "I guess I've asked you 100 times, Malcolm. Do you want to tell me what's wrong?" I shook her hand and said, "Nothing, Mrs. Swirlin." Then I went and got my things and came back down. At the living room door, I saw her wiping her eyes. I felt very bad. I thanked her and went out in front to Mr. Allen, who took me over to the Lyons. Mr. and Mrs. Lyons and their children, during the 2 months I lived with them while finishing 8th grade, also tried to get me to tell them what was wrong. But somehow I couldn't tell them either. I went every Saturday to see my brothers and sisters in Lansing, and almost every other day I wrote to Ella in Boston. Not saying why, I told Ella that I wanted to come there and live. I don't know how she did it, but she arranged for official custody of me to be transferred from Michigan to Massachusetts. and the very week I finished the 8th grade, I again boarded the Greyhound bus for Boston. I've thought about that time a lot since then. No physical move in my life has been more pivotal or profound in its repercussions. If I'd stayed on in Michigan, I would probably have married one of those Negro girls I knew and liked in Lansing. I might have become one of those state capitol building shoeshine boys, or a Lansing country club waiter, or gotten one of the other menial jobs which in those days among Lansing Negroes would have been considered successful, or even become a carpenter. Whatever I've done since then, I've driven myself to become a success at it. I've often thought that if Mr. Ostrowski had encouraged me to become a lawyer, I would today probably be among some city's professional black bourgeoisie, sipping cocktails and palming myself off as a community spokesman for and leader of the suffering black masses, while my primary concern would be to grab a few more crumbs from the groaning board of the two-faced whites with whom they're begging to integrate. All praise is due to Allah that I went to Boston when I did. If I hadn't, I'd probably still be a brainwashed black Christian. Chapter 3. Homeboy. I looked like Lil Abner. Mason, Michigan was written all over me. My kinky reddish hair was cut hick style, and I didn't even use grease in it. My green suit's coat sleeves stopped above my wrists. The pants legs showed 3 inches of socks. Just a shade lighter green than the suit was my narrow-collared three-quarter-length Lansing department store top coat. My appearance was too much for even Ella, but she told me later she had seen countrified members of the little family come up from Georgia in even worse shape than I was. Ella had fixed up a nice little upstairs room for me, and she was truly a Georgia Negro woman when she got into the kitchen with her pots and pans. She was the kind of cook who would heap up your plate with such as ham hock, greens, black-eyed peas, fried fish, cabbage, sweet potatoes, grits and gravy, and cornbread. And the more you put away, the better she felt. I worked out at Ella's kitchen table like there was no tomorrow. Ella still seemed to be as big, black, outspoken, and impressive a woman as she had been in Mason and Lansing. Only about 2 weeks before I arrived, she'd split up with her second husband, the soldier, Frank, whom I had met there the previous summer. But she was taking it right in stride. I could see, though I didn't say, how any average man would find it almost impossible to live for very long with a woman whose every instinct was to run everything and everybody she had anything to do with, including me. About my second day there in Roxbury, Ella told me that she didn't want me to start hunting for a job right away, like most newcomer Negroes did. She said that she had told all those she'd brought north to take their time, to walk around, to travel the buses and the subway, and get the feel of Boston before they tie themselves down working somewhere, because they would never again have the time to really see and get to know anything about the city they were living in. Ella said she'd help me find a job when it was time for me to go to work. So I went gawking around the neighborhood, the Wambeck and Humboldt Avenue Hill section of Roxbury, which is something like Harlem's Sugar Hill, where I'd later live. I saw those Roxbury Negroes acting and living differently from any black people I'd ever dreamed of in my life. This was the snooty black neighborhood. They called themselves the 400, and looked down their noses at the Negroes of the black ghetto, or so-called town section, where Mary, my other half-sister, lived. What I thought I was seeing there in Roxbury were high-class, educated, important Negroes living well, working in big jobs and positions. Their quiet homes sat back in their mowed yards. These Negroes walked along the sidewalks looking haughty and dignified, on their way to work, to shop, to visit, to church. I know now, of course, that what I was really seeing was only a big city version of those successful Negro bootblacks and janitors back in Lansing. The only difference was that the ones in Boston had been brainwashed even more thoroughly. They prided themselves on being incomparably more cultured, cultivated, dignified, and better off than their black brethren down in the ghetto, which was no further away than you could throw a rock. Under the pitiful misapprehension that it would make them better, these hill Negroes were breaking their backs trying to imitate white people. Any black family that had been around Boston long enough to own the home they lived in was considered among the hill elite. It didn't make any difference that they had to rent out rooms to make ends meet. Then the native-born New Englanders among them looked down upon recently migrated southern homeowners who lived next door, like Ella. And a big percentage of the hill dwellers were in Ella's category. Southern strivers and scramblers, and West Indian Negroes, whom both the New Englanders and the Southerners called Black Jews. Usually it was the Southerners and the West Indians who not only managed to own the places where they lived, but also at least one other house which they rented as income property. The snooty New Englanders usually owned less than they. In those days, on the Hill, any who could claim professional status, teachers, preachers, practical nurses, also considered themselves superior. Foreign diplomats could have modeled their conduct on the way the Negro postmen, Pullman porters, and dining car waiters of Roxbury acted, striding around as if they were wearing top hats and cutaways. I'd guess that 8 out of 10 of the Hill Negroes of Roxbury, despite the impressive-sounding job titles they affected, actually worked as menials and servants. He's in banking, or he's in securities. It sounded as though they were discussing a Rockefeller or a Mellon, and not some gray-headed, dignity-posturing bank janitor or bondhouse messenger. I'm with an old family was the euphemism used to dignify the professions of white folks' cooks and maids who talked so affectedly among their own kind in Roxbury that you couldn't even understand them. I don't know how many 40- and 50-year-old errand boys went down the hill dressed like ambassadors in black suits and white collars to downtown jobs in government, in finance, or in law. It has never ceased to amaze me how so many Negroes then and now could stand the indignity of that kind of self-delusion. Soon I ranged out of Roxbury and began to explore Boston proper. Historic buildings everywhere I turned, and plaques and markers and statues for famous events and men. One statue in the Boston Commons astonished me. A Negro named Crispus Attucks, who had been the first man to fall in the Boston Massacre. I'd never known anything like that. I roamed everywhere. In one direction, I walked as far as Boston University. Another day, I took my first subway ride. When most of the people got off, I followed. It was Cambridge, and I circled all around in the Harvard University campus. Somewhere, I'd already heard of Harvard, though I didn't know much more about it. Nobody that day could have told me I would give an address before the Harvard Law School Forum some 20 years later. I also did a lot of exploring downtown. Why a city would have 2 big railroad stations, North Station and South Station, I couldn't understand. At both of the stations, I stood around and watched people arrive and leave. And I did the same thing at the bus station where Ella had met me. My wanderings even led me down along the piers and docks, where I read plaques telling about the old sailing ships that used to put into port there. In a letter to Wilfred, Hilda, Filbert, and Reginald back in Lansing, I told them about all this and about the winding, narrow, cobblestone streets and the houses that jammed up against each other. Downtown Boston, I wrote them, had the biggest stores I'd ever seen, and white people's restaurants and hotels. I made up my mind that I was going to see every movie that came to the fine, air-conditioned theaters. On Massachusetts Avenue, next door to one of them, the Lowe's State Theater, was the huge, exciting Roseland State Ballroom. Big posters out in front advertised the nationally famous bands, white and Negro, that had played there. Coming next week, when I went by that first time, was Glenn Miller. I remember thinking how nearly the whole evening's music at Mason High School dances had been Glenn Miller's records. What wouldn't that crowd have given, I wondered, to be standing where Glenn Miller's band was actually going to play? I didn't know how familiar with Roseland I was going to become. Ella began to grow concerned, because even when I'd finally had enough sightseeing, I didn't stick around very much on the hill. She kept dropping hints that I ought to mingle with the nice young people my age, who were to be seen in the Townsend drugstore 2 blocks from her house, and a couple of other places. But even before I came to Boston, I'd always felt and acted toward anyone my age as if they were in the kid class, like my younger brother, Reginald. They'd always looked up to me as if I were considerably older. On weekends back in Lansing, where I'd go to get away from the white people in Mason, I'd hung around in the Negro part of town with Wilfred's and Filbert's set. Though all of them were several years older than me, I was bigger, and I actually looked older than most of them. I didn't want to disappoint or upset Ella, but despite her advice, I began going down into the town ghetto section. That world of grocery stores, walk-up flats, cheap restaurants, pool rooms, bars, storefront churches, and pawn shops seemed to hold a natural lure for me. Not only was this part of Roxbury much more exciting, but I felt more relaxed among Negroes who were being their natural selves and not putting on airs. Even though I did live on the hill, My instincts were never, and still aren't, to feel myself any better than any other Negro. I spent my first month in town with my mouth hanging open. The sharp-dressed young cats who hung on the corners and in the pool rooms, bars, and restaurants, and who obviously didn't work anywhere, completely entranced me. I couldn't get over marveling at how their hair was straight and shiny like white men's hair. Ella told me this was called a conch. I never tasted a sip of liquor, never even smoked a cigarette, and here I saw little black children, 10 and 12 years old, shooting craps, playing cards, fighting, getting grown-ups to put a penny or a nickel on their number for them, things like that. And these children threw around swear words I'd never heard before even, and slang expressions that were just as new to me, such as stud and cat and chick and cool and hip. Every night as I lay in bed, I turned these new words over in my mind. It was shocking to me that in town, especially after dark, you'd occasionally see a white girl and a Negro man strolling arm in arm along the sidewalk, and mixed couples drinking in the neon-lighted bars, not slipping off to some dark corner, as in Lansing. I wrote Wilfred and Filbert about that, too. I wanted to find a job myself, to surprise Ella. One afternoon, something told me to go inside a pool room whose window I was looking through. I looked through that window many times. I wasn't yearning to play pool. In fact, I never held a cue stick. But I was drawn by the sight of the cool-looking cats standing around inside, bending over the big, green, felt-topped tables, making bets and shooting the bright-colored balls into the holes. As I stared through the window this particular afternoon, something made me decide to venture inside and talk to a dark, stubby, conch-headed fellow who racked up balls for the pool players, whom I'd heard called Shorty. One day he'd come outside and see me standing there and said, "Hi, Red." So that made me figure he was friendly. As inconspicuously as I could, I slipped inside the door and around the side of the pool room, avoiding people, and on to the back, where Shorty was filling an aluminum can with the powder that pool players dust on their hands. He looked up at me. Later on, Shorty would enjoy teasing me about how, with that first glance, he knew my whole story. "Man, that cat still smelled country," he'd say, laughing. "Cat's legs were so long, and his pants so short his knees showed, and his head looked like a briar patch." But that afternoon, Shorty didn't let it show in his face how country I appeared when I told him I'd appreciate it if he'd tell me how could somebody go about getting a job like his. "If you mean racking up balls," said Shorty, "I don't know of no pool joints around here needing anybody. You mean you just want any slave you can find?" A slave meant work, a job. He asked what kind of work I'd done. I told him that I'd washed restaurant dishes in Mason, Michigan. He nearly dropped the powder can. "My homeboy, man, give me some skin. I'm from Lansing." I never told Shorty, and he never suspected, that he was about 10 years older than I. He took us to be about the same age. At first I would have been embarrassed to tell him. Later I just never bothered. Shorty had dropped out of first-year high school in Lansing, lived a while with an uncle and aunt in Detroit, and had spent the last 6 years living with his cousin in Roxbury. But when I mentioned the names of Lansing people and places, he remembered many, and pretty soon we sounded as if we'd been raised in the same block. I could sense Shorty's genuine gladness, and I don't have to say how lucky I felt to find a friend as hip as he obviously was. "Man, this is a swinging town if you dig it," Shorty said. "You're my homeboy. I'm going to school you to the happenings." I stood there and grinned like a fool. "You got to go anywhere now?" "Well, stick around till I get off." One thing I liked immediately about Shorty was his frankness. When I told him where I lived, he said what I already knew, that nobody in town could stand the hill Negroes. But he thought a sister who gave me a pad, not charging me rent, not even running me out to find some slave, couldn't be all bad. Shorty's slave in the pool room, he said, was just to keep ends together while he learned his horn. A couple of years before, he'd hit the numbers and bought a saxophone. "Got it right in there in the closet now for my lesson tonight." Shorty was taking lessons with some other studs, and he intended one day to organize his own small band. "There's a lot of bread to be made gigging right around here in Roxbury," Shorty explained to me. "I don't dig joining some big band, one-nighting all over just to say I played with Count or Duke or somebody." I thought that was smart. I wished I had studied a horn, but I never had been exposed to one. All afternoon, between trips up front to rack balls, Shorty talked to me out of the corner of his mouth, which hustlers standing around or playing at this or that table sold reefers, or had just come out of prison, or were second-story men. Shorty told me that he played at least $1 a day on the numbers. He said as soon as he hit a number, he would use the winnings to organize his band. I was ashamed to have to admit that I had never played the numbers. "Well, you ain't never had nothing to play with," he said, excusing me. But you start when you get a slave, and if you hit, you got a stake for something. He pointed out some gamblers and some pimps. Some of them had white whores, he whispered. I ain't going to lie. I dig them $2 white chicks, Shorty said. There's a lot of that action around here nights. You'll see it. I said I already had seen some. You ever had one? He asked. My embarrassment at my inexperience showed. Hell, man, he said. Don't be ashamed. I had a few before I left Lansing. Them Polack chicks that used to come over the bridge. Here they're mostly Italians and Irish. But it don't matter what kind. They're something else. Ain't no different nowhere. There's nothing they love better than a black stud. Through the afternoon, Shorty introduced me to players and loungers. My homeboy, he'd say. He's looking for a slave if you hear anything. They all said they'd look out. At 7 o'clock, when the night ball racket came on, Shorty told me I had to hurry to a saxophone lesson. But before he left, he held out to me the $6 or $7 he'd collected that day in nickel and dime tips. You got enough bread, homeboy? I was okay, I told him. I had $2. But Shorty made me take 3 more. Little fattening for your pocket, he said. Before we went out, he opened his saxophone case and showed me the horn. It was gleaming brass against the green velvet. An alto sax. He said, keep cool, homeboy, and come back tomorrow. Some of the cats will turn you up a slave. When I got home, Ella said there'd been a telephone call from somebody named Shorty. He left a message that over at the Roseland State Ballroom, the shoeshine boy was quitting that night, and Shorty had told him to hold the job for me. Malcolm, you haven't had any experience shining shoes, Ella said. Her expression and tone of voice told me she wasn't happy about my taking that job. I didn't particularly care because I was already speechless thinking about being somewhere close to the greatest bands in the world. I didn't even wait to eat any dinner. The ballroom was all lighted when I got there. A man at the front door was letting in members of Benny Goodman's band. I told him I wanted to see the shoeshine boy, Freddie. You going to be the new one? He asked. I said I thought I was, and he laughed. Well, maybe you'll hit the numbers and get a Cadillac, too. He told me that I'd find Freddie upstairs in the men's room on the second floor. But downstairs, before I went up, I stepped over and snatched a glimpse inside the ballroom. I just couldn't believe the size of that waxed floor. At the far end, under the soft rose-colored lights, was the bandstand with the Benny Goodman musicians moving around, laughing and talking, arranging their horns and stands. A wiry, brown-skinned, conked fellow upstairs in the men's room greeted me. You Shorty's homeboy? I said I was, and he said he was Freddie. Good old boy, he said. He called me. He just heard I hit the big number. And he figured right, I'd be quitting. I told Freddie what the man at the front door had said about a Cadillac. He laughed and said, burns them white cats up when you get yourself something. Yeah, I told him I was going to get me one, just to bug them. Freddie then said for me to pay close attention, that he was going to be busy, and for me to watch, but not get in the way. And he tried to get me ready to take over the next dance, a couple of nights later. As Freddie busied himself setting up the shoeshine stand, he told me, get here early. Your shoeshine rags and brushes by this footstand. Your polish bottles, paste wax, suede brushes over here. Everything in place. You get rushed, you never need to waste motion. While you shine shoes, I learned, you also kept watch on customers inside, leaving the urinals. You darted over and offered a small white hand towel. A lot of cats who ain't planning to wash their hands, sometimes you can run up with a towel and shame them. Your towels are really your best hustle in here. Cost you a penny apiece to launder. You always get at least a nickel tip. The shoeshine customers and any from the inside restroom who took a towel, you whisk-broomed a couple of licks. A nickel or a dime tip, just give them that, Freddie said. But for 2 bits, Uncle Tom a little. White cats especially like that. I've had them to come back 2-3 times a dance. From down below, the sound of the music had begun floating up. I guess I stood transfixed. You never seen a big dance? Asked Freddie. Run on a while and watch. There were a few couples already dancing under the rose-colored lights. But even more exciting to me was the crowd thronging in. The most glamorous-looking white women I'd ever seen. Young ones, old ones, white cats buying tickets at the window, sticking big wads of green bills back into their pockets, checking the women's coats, and taking their arms and squiring them inside. Freddie had some early customers when I got back upstairs. Between the shoeshine stand and thrusting towels to me just as they approached the wash basin, Freddie seemed to be doing 4 things at once. Here, you can take off the whisk-broom, he said. Just 2 or 3 licks, but let them feel it. When things slowed a little, he said, you ain't seen nothing tonight. You wait until you see a spooks dance. Man, our own people carry on. Whenever he had a moment, he kept schooling me. Shoelaces, this drawer here. You're just starting out. I'm going to make these to you as a present. Buy them for a nickel a pair. Tell cats they need laces if they do, and charge 2 bits. Every Benny Goodman record I'd ever heard in my life, it seemed, was filtering faintly into where we were. During another customer lull, Freddie let me slip back outside again to listen. Peggy Lee was at the mic singing. Beautiful. She'd just joined the band, and she was from North Dakota, and had been singing with a group in Chicago when Mrs. Benny Goodman discovered her. We'd heard some customers say. She finished the song, and the crowd burst into applause. She was a big hit. "It knocked me out, too, when I first broke in here," Freddie said, grinning, when I went back in there. "But look, you ever shine any shoes?" He laughed when I said I hadn't, excepting my own. "Well, let's get to work. I never had neither." Freddie got on the stand and went to work on his own shoes. Brush, liquid polish, brush, paste wax, shine rag, lacquer sole dressing. Step by step, Freddie showed me what to do. "But you got to get a whole lot faster. You can't waste time." Freddie showed me how fast on my own shoes. Then, because business was tapering off, he had time to give me a demonstration of how to make the shine rag pop like a firecracker. "Dig the action?" he asked. He did it in slow motion. I got down and tried it on his shoes. I had the principle of it. "Just got to do it faster," Freddie said. "It's a jive noise, that's all. Cats tip better. They figure you're knocking yourself out." By the end of the dance, Freddie let me shine the shoes of three or four stray drunks he talked into having shines, and I practiced picking up my speed on Freddie's shoes until they looked like mirrors. After we'd helped the janitors to clean up the ballroom after the dance, throwing out all the paper and cigarette butts and empty liquor bottles, Freddie was nice enough to drive me all the way home to Ella's on the Hill in the second-hand maroon Buick he said he was going to trade in on his Cadillac. He talked to me all the way. "I guess it's all right if I tell you. Pick up a couple of dozen packs of rubbers, 2 bits apiece. You notice some of those cats that came up to me around the end of the dance? Well, when some have new chicks going right, they'll come asking you for rubbers. Charge a dollar. Generally, you'll get an extra tip." He looked across at me. "Some hustles you're too new for. Cats will ask you for liquor. Some will want reefers. But you don't need to have nothing except rubbers until you can dig who's a cop. You can make $10, $12 a dance for yourself if you work everything right," Freddie said, before I got out of the car in front of Ella's. "The main thing you got to remember is that everything in the world is a hustle. So long, Red." The next time I ran into Freddie, I was downtown one night a few weeks later. He was parked in his pearl gray Cadillac, sharp as a tack, cooling it. "Man, you sure schooled me," I said, and he laughed. He knew what I meant. It hadn't taken me long on the job to find out that Freddie had done less shoe shining and towel hustling than selling liquor and reefers and putting white Johns in touch with Negro whores. I also learned that white girls always flocked to the Negro dances, some of them whores whose pimps brought them to mixed business and pleasure, others who came with their black boyfriends, and some who came in alone for a little freelance lusting among a plentiful availability of enthusiastic Negro men. At the white dances, of course, nothing black was allowed. And that's where the black whore's pimps soon showed a new shoeshine boy what he could pick up on the side by slipping a phone number or address to the white Johns who came around the end of the dance looking for black chicks. Most of Roseland's dances were for whites only, and they had white bands only. But the only white band ever to play there at a Negro dance, to my recollection, was Charlie Barnett's. The fact is that very few white bands could have satisfied the Negro dancers, but I know that Charlie Barnett's Cherokee and his Redskin Roomba drove those Negroes wild. They jam-packed that ballroom, the black girls in way-out silk and satin dresses and shoes, their hair done in all kinds of styles, the men sharp in their zoot suits and crazy conks, and everybody grinning and greased and gassed. Some of the band's men would come up to the men's room at about 8 o'clock and get shoeshines before they went to work. Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Lionel Hampton, Cootie Williams, Jimmy Lunsford were just a few of those who sat in my chair. I would really make my shine rag sound like someone had set off Chinese firecrackers. Duke's great alto saxman, Johnny Hodges, he was Shorty's idol, still owes me for a shoeshine I gave him. He was in the chair one night having a friendly argument with the drummer, Sonny Greer, who was standing there, when I tapped the bottom of his shoes to signal that I was finished. Hodges stepped down, reaching his hand in his pocket to pay me, but then snatched his hand out to gesture and just forgot me and walked away. I wouldn't have dared to bother the man who could do what he did with Daydream by asking him for 15 cents. I remember that I struck up a little shoeshine stand conversation with Count Basie's great blues singer, Jimmy Rushing. He's the one famous for "Sent for You Yesterday, Here You Come Today," and things like that. Rushing's feet, I remember, were big and funny-shaped. Not long like most big feet, but they were round and roly-poly like Rushing. Anyhow, he even introduced me to some of the other Basie cats, like Lester Young, Harry Edison, Buddy Tate, Don Bias, Dickie Wells, and Buck Clayton. They'd walk in the restroom later by themselves. "Hi, Red." They'd be up there in my chair, and my shine rag was popping to the beat of all of their records, spinning in my head. Musicians never have had anywhere a greater shoeshine boy fan than I was. I would write to Wilfred and Hilda and Filbert and Reginald back in Lansing, trying to describe it. I never got any decent tips until the middle of the Negro dances, which is when the dancers started feeling good and getting generous. After the white dances, when I helped to clean out the ballroom, we would throw out perhaps a dozen empty liquor bottles. But after the Negro dances, we would have to throw out cartons full of empty fifth bottles. Not Rotgut either, but the best brands, and especially Scotch. During lulls up there in the men's room, sometimes I'd get in 5 minutes of watching the dancing. The white people danced as though somebody had trained them. Left, one, two, right, three, four. The same steps and patterns over and over, as though somebody had wound them up. But those Negroes, nobody in the world could have choreographed the way they did whatever they felt, just grabbing partners, even the white chicks who came to the Negro dances. And my black brethren today may hate me for saying it, but a lot of black girls nearly got run over by some of those Negro males scrambling to get at those white women. You would have thought God had lowered some of his angels. Times have sure changed. If it happened today, those same black girls would go after those Negro men, and the white women, too. Anyway, some couples were so abandoned, flinging high and wide, improvising steps and movements, that you couldn't believe it. I could feel the beat in my bones, even though I'd never danced. Show time! People would start hollering about the last hour of the dance. Then a couple of dozen really wild couples would stay on the floor, the girls changing to low white sneakers. The band now would really be blasting, and all the other dancers would form a clapping, shouting circle to watch that wild competition as it began, covering only a quarter or so of the ballroom floor. The band, the spectators, and the dancers would be making the Roseland Ballroom feel like a big, rocking ship. The spotlight would be turning pink, yellow, green, and blue, picking up the couples lindy-hopping as if they'd gone mad. "Wail, man, wail!" people would be shouting at the band, and it would be wailing, until first one and then another couple just ran out of strength and stumbled off toward the crowd, exhausted and soaked with sweat. Sometimes I would be down there standing inside the door, jumping up and down in my gray jacket with a whisk broom in the pocket, and the manager would have to come and shout at me that I had customers upstairs. The first liquor I drank, my first cigarettes, even my first reefers, I can't specifically remember, but I know they were all mixed together with my first shooting craps, playing cards, and betting my dollar a day on the numbers as I started hanging out at night with Shorty and his friends. Shorty's jokes about how country I'd been made us all laugh. I still was country, I know now, but it all felt so great because I was accepted. All of us would be in somebody's place, usually one of the girls, and we'd be turning on, the reefers making everybody's head light, or the whiskey aglow in our middles. Everybody understood that my head had to stay kinky a while longer, to grow long enough for Shorty to conk it for me. One of these nights I remarked that I'd saved about half enough to get a zoot. Save? Shorty couldn't believe it. Homeboy, you never heard of credit. He told me he'd call a neighborhood clothing store the first thing in the morning, and that I should be there early. A salesman, a young Jew, met me when I came in. "You Shorty's friend?" I said I was. It amazed me. All of Shorty's contacts. The salesman wrote my name on a form, and the Roseland is where I worked, and Ella's address as where I lived. Shorty's name was put down as recommending me. The salesman said, "Shorty's one of our best customers." I was measured, and the young salesman picked off a rack a zoot suit that was just wild. Sky blue pants 30 inches in the knee, an angle narrowed down to 12 inches at the bottom, and a long coat that pinched my waist and flared out below my knees. As a gift, the salesman said, the store would give me a narrow leather belt with my initial L on it. Then he said I ought to also buy a hat, and I did, blue, with a feather in the 4-inch brim. Then the store gave me another present, a long, thick-linked, gold-plated chain that swung down lower than my coat hem. I was sold forever on credit. When I modeled the zoot for Ella, she took a long look and said, "Well, I guess it had to happen." I took three of those 25-cent sepia-toned While You Wait pictures of myself, posed the way hipsters wearing their zoots would cool it. Hat dangled, knees drawn close together, feet wide apart, both index fingers jabbed toward the floor. The long coat and swinging chain and the Punjab pants were much more dramatic if you stood that way. One picture I autographed and airmailed to my brothers and sisters in Lansing to let them see how well I was doing. I gave another one to Ella, and the third to Shorty, who was really moved. I could tell by the way he said, "Thanks, homeboy." It was part of our hip code not to show that kind of affection. Shorty soon decided that my hair was finally long enough to be conked. He promised to school me in how to beat the barbershop's $3 and $4 price by making up congaline and then conking ourselves. I took the little list of ingredients he had printed out for me and went to a grocery store, where I got a can of Red Devil Lye, 2 eggs, and 2 medium-sized white potatoes. Then, at a drugstore near the pool room, I asked for a large jar of Vaseline, a large bar of soap, a large toothed comb, and a fine toothed comb, one of those rubber hoses with a metal spray head, a rubber apron, and a pair of gloves. "Going to lay on that first conk?" the drugstore man asked me. I proudly told him, grinning, "Right." Shorty paid $6 a week for a room in his cousin's shabby apartment. His cousin wasn't at home. "It's like the pad's mine. He spends so much time with his woman," Shorty said. "Now you watch me." He peeled the potatoes and thin sliced them into a quart-sized mason fruit jar, then started stirring them with a wooden spoon as he gradually poured in a little over half the can of lye. "Never use a metal spoon. The lye will turn it black," he told me. A jelly-like, starchy-looking glop resulted from the lye and potatoes, and Shorty broke in the 2 eggs, stirring real fast. His own conk and dark face bent down close. The congaline turned pale yellowish. "Feel the jar," Shorty said. I cupped my hand against the outside and snatched it away. "Damn right, it's hot. That's the lye," he said. "So you know it's going to burn when I comb it in. It burns bad. But the longer you can stand it, the straighter the hair." He made me sit down, and he tied the string of the new rubber apron tightly around my neck and combed up my bush of hair. Then, from the big Vaseline jar, he took a handful and massaged it hard all through my hair and into the scalp. He also thickly Vaselined my neck, ears, and forehead. "When I get to washing out your head, be sure to tell me anywhere you feel any little stinging," Shorty warned me, washing his hands, then pulling on the rubber gloves and tying on his own rubber apron. "You always got to remember that any congaline left in burns a sore into your head." The congaline just felt warm when Shorty started combing it in. But then my head caught fire. I gritted my teeth and tried to pull the sides of the kitchen table together. The comb felt as if it was raking my skin off. My eyes watered. My nose was running. I couldn't stand it any longer. I bolted to the wash basin. I was cursing Shorty with every name I could think of when he got the spray going and started soap lathering my head. He lathered and spray rinsed. Lathered and spray rinsed. Maybe 10 or 12 times, each time gradually closing the hot water faucet until the rinse was cold, and that helped some. "You feel any stinging spots?" "No," I managed to say. My knees were trembling. "Sit back down, then. I think we got it all out okay." The flame came back as Shorty, with a thick towel, started drying my head, rubbing hard. "Easy, man, easy," I kept shouting. "The first time's always worst. You get used to it better before long. You took it real good, homeboy. You got a good conk." When Shorty let me stand up and see in the mirror, my hair hung down in limp, damp strings. My scalp still flamed, but not as badly. I could bear it. He draped the towel around my shoulders over my rubber apron and began again Vaselining my hair. I could feel him combing straight back, first the big comb, then the fine tooth one. Then he was using a razor very delicately on the back of my neck, then finally shaping the sideburns. My first view in the mirror blotted out the hurting. I'd seen some pretty conks, but when it's the first time on your own head, the transformation after the lifetime of kinks is staggering. The mirror reflected Shorty behind me. We both were grinning and sweating. And on top of my head was this thick, smooth sheen of shining red hair. Real red. As straight as any white man's. How ridiculous I was. Stupid enough to stand there simply lost in admiration of my hair now looking white, reflected in the mirror in Shorty's room. I vowed that I'd never again be without a conk, and I never was for many years. This was my first really big step toward self-degradation. When I endured all of that pain, literally burning my flesh to have it look like a white man's hair. I join that multitude of Negro men and women in America who are brainwashed into believing that the black people are inferior and white people superior, that they will even violate and mutilate their God-created bodies to try to look pretty by white standards. Look around today in every small town and big city, from two-bit catfish and soda pop joints into the integrated lobby of the Waldorf Astoria, and you'll see cunks on black men. And you'll see black women wearing these green and pink and purple and red and platinum blonde wigs. They're all more ridiculous than a slapstick comedy. It makes you wonder if the Negro has completely lost his sense of identity, lost touch with himself. You'll see the conk worn by many, many so-called upper-class Negroes. And as much as I hate to say it about them, on all too many Negro entertainers. One of the reasons that I've especially admired some of them, like Lionel Hampton and Sidney Poitier, among others, is that they have kept their natural hair and fought to the top. I admire any Negro man who has never had himself conked or has had the sense to get rid of it, as I finally did. I don't know which kind of self-defacing conk is the greater shame, the one you'll see on the heads of the black so-called middle class and upper class who ought to know better, or the one you'll see on the heads of the poorest, most downtrodden, ignorant black men. I mean the legal, minimum-wage, ghetto-dwelling kind of Negro, as I was when I got my first one. It's generally among these poor fools that you see a black kerchief over the man's head, like Aunt Jemima. He's trying to make his conk last longer, between trips to the barbershop. Only for special occasions is this kerchief-protected conk exposed, to show off how sharp and hip its owner is. The ironic thing is that I have never heard any woman, white or black, express any admiration for a conk. Of course, any white woman with a black man isn't thinking about his hair. But I don't see how on earth a black woman with any race pride could walk down the street with any black man wearing a conk, the emblem of his shame that he is black. To my own shame, when I say all of this, I'm talking first of all about myself, because you can't show me any Negro who ever conked more faithfully than I did. I'm speaking from personal experience when I say of any black man who conks today, or any white-wigged black woman, that if they gave the brains in their heads just half as much attention as they do their hair, they would be 1,000 times better off. Chapter 4. Laura. Shorty would take me to groovy, frantic scenes and different chicks and cats' pads, where with the lights and juke down mellow, everybody blew gauge and juiced back and jumped. I met chicks who were fine as May wine and cats who were hip to all happenings. That paragraph is deliberate, of course. It's just to display a bit more of the slang that was used by everyone I respected as hip in those days. And in no time at all, I was talking the slang like a lifelong hipster. Like hundreds of thousands of country-bred Negroes who had come to the northern black ghetto before me and have come since, I'd also acquired all the other fashionable ghetto adornments. The zoot suits and conk that I've described, liquor, cigarettes, then reefers, all to erase my embarrassing background. But I still harbored one secret humiliation. I couldn't dance. I can't remember when it was that I actually learned how. That is to say, I can't recall the specific night or nights. But dancing was the chief action at those pad parties, so I've no doubt about how and why my initiation into lindy hopping came about. With alcohol and marijuana lightening my head, and that wild music wailing away on those portable record players, it didn't take long to loosen up the dancing instincts in my African heritage. All I remember is that during some party around this time, when nearly everyone but me was up dancing, some girl grabbed me. They often would take the initiative and grab a partner, but no girl at those parties ever would dream that anyone present couldn't dance. And there I was, out on the floor. I was up in the jostling crowd, and suddenly, unexpectedly, I got the idea. It was as though somebody had clicked on a light. My long-suppressed African instincts broke through, and loose. Having spent so much time in Mason's white environment, I'd always believed and feared that dancing involved a certain order or pattern of specific steps, as dancing is done by whites. But here among my own less inhibited people, I discovered it was simply letting your feet, hands, and body spontaneously act out whatever impulses were stirred by the music. From then on, hardly a party took place without me turning up. inviting myself if I had to, and Lindy hopping my head off. I'd always been fast at picking up new things. I made up for lost time now so fast that soon girls were asking me to dance with them. I worked my partners hard. That's why they liked me so much. When I was at work up in the Roseland men's room, I just couldn't keep still. My shine rag popped with the rhythm of those great bands rocking the ballroom. White customers on the shine stand especially would laugh to see my feet suddenly break loose on their own and cut a few steps. Whites are correct in thinking that black people are natural dancers. Even little kids are, except for those Negroes today who are so integrated, as I'd been, that their instincts are inhibited. You know those dancing jigaboo toys that you wind up? Well, I was like a live one. Music just wound me up. By the next dance for the Boston black folk, I remember that Lionel Hampton was coming into play. I'd given my notice to the Roselands manager. When I told Ella why I'd quit, she laughed aloud. I told her I couldn't find time to shine shoes and dance, too. She was glad because she'd never liked the idea of my working at that no-prestige job. When I told Shorty, he said he'd known I'd soon outgrow it anyway. Shorty could dance all right himself, but for his own reasons, he never cared about going to the big dances. He loved just the music-making end of it. He practiced his saxophone and listened to records. It astonished me that Shorty didn't care to go and hear the big bands play. He had his alto sax idol, Johnny Hodges, with Duke Ellington's band, but he said he thought too many young musicians were only carbon copying the big band names on the same instrument. Anyway, Shorty was really serious about nothing except his music and about working for the day when he could start his own little group to gig around Boston. The morning after I quit Roseland, I was down at the men's clothing store bright and early. The salesman checked and found that I'd missed only one weekly payment. I had A1 credit. I told him I'd just quit my job, but he said that didn't make any difference. I could miss paying them for a couple of weeks if I had to. He knew I'd get straight. This time, I studied carefully everything in my size on the racks, and finally I picked out my second zoot. It was a shark skin gray, with a big, long coat and pants ballooning out at the knees and then tapering down to cuffs so narrow that I had to take off my shoes to get them on and off. With the salesman urging me on, I got another shirt and a hat and new shoes, the kind that were just coming into hipster style, dark orange-colored, with paper-thin soles and knob-style toes. It all added up to $70 or $80. It was such a red-letter day that I even went and got my first barbershop conk. This time it didn't hurt so much, just as Shorty had predicted. That night, I timed myself to hit Roseland as the thick of the crowd was coming in. In the thronging lobby, I saw some of the real Roxbury hipsters eyeing my zoot, and some fine women were giving me that look. I sauntered up to the men's room for a short drink from the pint in my inside coat pocket. My replacement was there, a scared, narrow-faced, hungry-looking little brown-skinned fellow just in town from Kansas City. And when he recognized me, he couldn't keep down his admiration and wonder. I told him to keep cool, that he'd soon catch on to the happenings. Everything felt right when I went into the ballroom. Hamp's band was working, and that big wax floor was packed with people lindy hopping like crazy. I grabbed some girl I'd never seen, and the next thing I knew we were out there lindying away and grinning at each other. It couldn't have been finer. I'd been lindying previously only in cramped little apartment living rooms, and now I had room to maneuver. Once I really got myself warmed and loosened up, I was snatching partners from among the hundreds of unattached freelancing girls along the sidelines. Almost every one of them could really dance, and I just about went wild, Hamp's band wailing. I was whirling girls so fast their skirts were snapping. Black girls, brown skins, high yellows, even a couple of the white girls there, boosting them over my hips, my shoulders, into the air. Though I wasn't quite 16 then, I was tall and raw-boned and looked like 21. I was also pretty strong for my age. Circling, tap-dancing, I was underneath them when they landed, doing the flapping eagle, the kangaroo, and the split. After that, I never missed a Roseland Lindy Hop as long as I stayed in Boston. The greatest Lindy dancing partner I had, everything considered, was a girl named Laura. I met her at my next job. When I quit shoe-shining, Ella was so happy that she went around asking about a job for me, one she would approve. Just two blocks from her house, the Townsend drugstore was about to replace its soda fountain clerk, a fellow who was leaving to go off to college. When Ella told me, I didn't like it. She knew I couldn't stand those hill characters. But speaking my mind right then would have made Ella mad. I didn't want that to happen. So I put on the white jacket and started serving up sodas, sundaes, splits, shakes, and all the rest of that fountain stuff to those fancy-acting Negroes. Every evening when I got off at 8 and came home, Ella would keep saying, I hope you meet some of these nice young people your age here in Roxbury. But those penny ante squares who came in there putting on their millionaires' airs, the young ones and the old ones both, only annoyed me. People like the sleep-in maid for Beacon Hill white folks used to come in with her, ooh, my dear, manners, and order corn plasters in the Jews' drugstore for black folks. Or the hospital cafeteria line serving woman sitting there on her day off with a cat fur around her neck, telling the proprietor she was a dietitian, both of them knowing she was lying. Even the young ones my age, whom Ella was always talking about. The soda fountain was one of their hangouts. They soon had me ready to quit with their accents so phonied up that if you just heard them and didn't see them, you wouldn't even know they were Negroes. I couldn't wait for 8 o'clock to get home to eat out of those soul food pots of Ella's, then get dressed in my zoot and head for some of my friends' places in town to Lindy Hop and get high or something for relief from those hill clowns. Before long, I didn't see how I was going to be able to stick it out there 8 hours a day, and I nearly didn't. I remember one night I nearly quit because I'd hit the numbers for 10 cents, the first time I'd ever hit on one of the sideline bets that I'd made in the drugstore. Yes, there were several runners on the hill. Even dignified Negroes played to numbers. I won $60, and Shorty and I had a ball with it. I wished I'd hit for the daily dollar that I played with my town man, paying him by the week. I would surely have quit the drugstore. I could have bought a car. Anyway, Laura lived in a house that was catacorned across the street from the drugstore. After a while, as soon as I saw her coming in, I'd start making up a banana split. She was a real bug for them. She came in late every afternoon after school. I imagine I'd been shoving that ice cream dish under her nose for 5 or 6 weeks before somehow it began to sink in that she wasn't like the rest. She was certainly the only hill girl that came in there and acted in any way friendly and natural. She always had some book with her, and poring over it, she would make a 30-minute job of that daily dish of banana split. I began to notice the books she read. They were pretty heavy school stuff, Latin, algebra, things like that. Watching her made me reflect that I hadn't read even a newspaper since leaving Mason. Laura. I heard her name called by a few of the others who came in when she was there, but I could see they didn't know her too well. They said hello. That was about the extent of it. She kept to herself, and she never said more than thank you to me. Nice voice. Soft. Quiet. Never another word. But no airs like the others. No black Bostonese. She was just herself. I liked that. Before too long, I struck up a conversation. Just what subject I got off on, I don't remember. But she readily opened up and began talking, and she was very friendly. I found out that she was a high school junior, an honor student. Her parents had split up when she was a baby, and she'd been raised by a grandmother, an old lady on a pension, who was very strict and old-fashioned and religious. Laura had just one close friend, a girl who lived over in Cambridge, whom she had gone to school with. They talked on the telephone every day. Her grandmother scarcely ever let her go to the movies, let alone on dates. But Laura really liked school. She said she wanted to go on to college. She was keen for algebra, and she planned to major in science. Laura never would have dreamed that she was a year older than I was. I gauged that indirectly. She looked up to me as though she felt I had a world of experience more than she did, which really was the truth. But sometimes, when she'd gone, I felt let down, thinking how I had turned away from the books I used to like when I was back in Michigan. I got to the point where I looked forward to her coming in every day after school. I stopped letting her pay and gave her extra ice cream, and she wasn't hiding the fact that she liked me. It wasn't long before she'd stop reading her books when she came in, would just sit and eat and talk with me. And soon she began trying to get me to talk about myself. I was immediately sorry when I dropped that I had once thought about becoming a lawyer. She didn't want to let me rest about that. Malcolm, there's no reason why you can't pick up right where you are and become a lawyer. She had the idea that my sister Ella would help me as much as she could. And if Ella had ever thought that she could help any member of the little family put up any kind of professional shingle, as a teacher, a foot doctor, anything, why, you would have had to tie her down to keep her from taking in washing. I never mentioned Laura to Shorty. I just knew she never would have understood him or that crowd, and they wouldn't have understood her. She'd never been touched, I'm certain she hadn't, or even had a drink, and she wouldn't even have known what a reefer was. It was a great surprise to me when one afternoon Laura happened to let drop that she just loved Lindy Hopping. I asked her how she'd been able to go out dancing. She said she'd been introduced to Lindy Hopping at a party given by the parents of some Negro friend just accepted by Harvard. It was just about time to start closing down the soda fountain, and I said that Count Basie was playing the Roseland that weekend, and would she like to go? Laura's eyes got wide. I thought I'd have to catch her, she was so excited. She said she'd never been there. She'd heard so much about it, she'd imagine what it was like. She'd just give anything. But her grandma would have a fit. So I said maybe some other time. But the afternoon before the dance, Laura came in full of excitement. She whispered that she'd never lied to her grandma before, but she told her that she had to attend some school function that evening. If I'd get her home early, she'd meet me. If I'd still take her. I told her we'd have to go by for me to change clothes at the house. She hesitated, but said okay. Before we left, I telephoned Elder to say I'd be bringing a girl by on the way to the dance. Though I'd never before done anything like it, Ella covered up her surprise. I laughed to myself a long time afterward about how Ella's mouth flew open when we showed up at the front door. Me and a well-bred Hill girl. Laura, when I introduced her, was warm and sincere. And Ella, you would have thought she was closing in on her third husband. While they sat and talked downstairs, I dressed upstairs in my room. I remember changing my mind about the wild, sharkskin gray suit I'd planned to wear, and deciding instead to put on the first one I'd gotten, the blue suit. I knew I should wear the most conservative thing I had. They were like old friends when I came back down. Ella had even made tea. Ella's hawkeye just about raked my suit right off my back, but I'm sure she was grateful that I'd at least put on the blue one. Knowing Ella, I knew that she'd already extracted Laura's entire life story, and all but had the wedding bells around my neck. I grinned all the way to the Roseland in the taxi, because I'd showed Ella I could hang out with Hill girls if I wanted to. Laura's eyes were so big. She said almost none of her acquaintances knew her grandmother, who never went anywhere but to church, so there wasn't much danger of it getting back to her. The only person she'd told was her girlfriend, who had shared her excitement. Then suddenly we were in the Roseland's jostling lobby, and I was getting waves and smiles and greetings. They shouted, "My man!" and "Hey, Red!" and I answered, "Daddy-o!" She and I never before had danced together, but that certainly was no problem. Any two people who can lindy at all can lindy together. We just started out there on the floor among a lot of other couples. It was maybe halfway in the number before I became aware of how she danced. If you've ever lindy-hopped, you know what I'm talking about. With most girls, you kind of work opposite them, circling, sidestepping, leading. Whichever arm you lead with is half-bent out there, your hands are giving that little pull, that little push, touching her waist, her shoulders, her arms. She's in, out, turning, whirling, wherever you guide her. With poor partners, you feel their weight. They're slow and heavy. But with really good partners, all you need is just the push-pull suggestion. They guide nearly effortlessly, even off the floor and into the air, and your little solo maneuver is done on the floor before they land, when they join you whirling right in step. I danced with plenty of good partners. But what I became suddenly aware of with Laura was that I'd never before felt so little weight. I'd nearly just think a maneuver, and she'd respond. Anyway, she danced up, down, under my arm, flinging out. While I felt her out and examined her style, I glimpsed her footwork. I can close my eyes right now and see it, like some blurring ballet. Beautiful. And her lightness, like a shadow. My perfect partner, if somebody had asked me, would have been one who handled as lightly as Laura and who would have the strength to last through a long, tough showtime. But I knew that Laura wouldn't begin to be that strong. In Harlem, years later, a friend of mine called Sammy the Pimp taught me something I wish I'd known then to look for in Laura's face. It was what Sammy declared was his infallible clue for determining the unconscious, true personality of women. Considering all the women he had picked out of crowds and turned into prostitutes, Sammy qualified as an expert. Anyway, he swore that if a woman, any woman, gets really carried away while dancing, what she truly is, at least potentially, will surface and show on her face. I'm not suggesting that a lady of easy virtue look danced to the surface in Laura, although life did deal her cruel blows, starting with her meeting me. All I am saying is that it may be that if I had been equipped with Sammy's ability, I might have spotted in Laura then some of the subsurface potential destined to become real that would have shocked her grandma. A third of the way or so through the evening, the main vocalizing and instrumental stylings would come, and then showtime, when only the greatest lindy hoppers would stay on the floor to try and eliminate each other. All the other dancers would form a big U with the band at the open end. The girls who intended to compete would slip over to the sidelines and change from high heels into low white sneakers. In competition, they never could survive in heels. And always among them were four or five unattached girls who would run around trying to hook up with some guy they knew could really Lindy. Now Count Basie turned on the Showtime blast, and the other dancers moved off the floor, shifting for good watching positions, and began their hollering for their favorites. "All right now, Red," they shouted to me. "Go get 'em, Red." And then a freelancing Lindy girl I'd danced with before, Mamie Bevels, a waitress and a wild dancer, ran up to me with Laura standing right there. I wasn't sure what to do, but Laura started backing away toward the crowd, still looking at me. The Count's band was wailing. I grabbed Mamie and we started to work. She was a big, rough, strong gal, and she lindied like a bucking horse. I remember the very night that she became known as one of the Showtime favorites there at the Roseland. A band was screaming when she kicked off her shoes and got barefooted and shouted and shook herself as if she were in some African jungle frenzy, and then she let loose with some dancing, shouting with every step until the guy that was out there with her nearly had to fight her to control her. The crowd loved any way-out lindying style that made a colorful show like that. It was how Mamie had become known. Anyway, I started driving like a horse, the way she liked. When we came off the floor after the first number, we both were wringing wet with sweat, and people were shouting and pounding our backs. I remember leaving early with Laura to get her home in time. She was very quiet, and she didn't have much to say for the next week or so when she came into the drugstore. Even then, I'd learned enough about women to know not to pressure them when they're thinking something out. They'll tell you when they're ready. Every time I saw Ella, even brushing my teeth in the morning, she turned on the third degree. When was I seeing Laura again? Was I going to bring her by again? What a nice girl she is. Ella had picked her out for me. But in that kind of way, I thought hardly anything about the girl. When it came to personal matters, my mind was strictly on getting sharp in my zoot as soon as I left work and racing downtown to hang out with Short and the other guys, and with the girls they knew, a million miles away from the stuck-up hill. I wasn't even thinking about Laura when she came up to me in the drugstore and asked me to take her to the next Negro dance at the Roseland. Duke Ellington was going to play, and she was beside herself with excitement. I had no way to know what was going to happen. She asked me to pick her up at her house this time. I didn't want any contact with the old grandma she had described, but I went. Grandma answered the door, an old-fashioned, wrinkled black woman with fuzzy gray hair. She just opened the door enough for me to get in, not even saying as much as, "Come in, dog." I've faced armed detectives and gangsters less hostile than she was. I remember the musty living room, full of those old Christ pictures, prayers woven into tapestries, statuettes of the crucifixion, other religious objects on the mantel, shelves, tabletops, walls, everywhere. Since the old lady wasn't speaking to me, I didn't speak to her either. I completely sympathize with her now, of course. What could she have thought of me in my zoot and conk and orange shoes? She'd have done us all a favor if she'd run screaming for the police. If something looked as I did then ever came knocking at my door today, asking to see one of my four daughters, I know I would explode. When Laura rushed into the room, jerking on her coat, I could see that she was upset and angry and embarrassed. And in the taxi, she started crying. She'd hated herself for lying before. She'd decided to tell the truth about where she was going, and there'd been a screaming battle with Grandma. Laura told the old lady that she was going to start going out when and where she wanted to, or she would quit school and get a job and move out on her own, and her grandma had pitched a fit. Laura just walked out. When we got to the Roseland, we danced the early part of the evening with each other and with different partners. And finally, the Duke kicked off Showtime. I knew, and Laura knew, that she couldn't match the veteran Showtime girls, but she told me that she wanted to compete. And the next thing I knew, she was among those girls over on the sidelines changing into sneakers. I shook my head when a couple of the freelancing girls ran up to me. As always, the crowd clapped and shouted in time with a blasting band. "Go, Red, go!" Partly it was my reputation and partly Laura's ballet style of dancing that helped turn the spotlight and the crowd's attention to us. They never had seen the feather lightness that she gave to Lindying, a completely fresh style, and they were connoisseurs of styles. I turned up the steam. Laura's feet were flying. I had her in the air, down, sideways, around, backwards, up again, down, whirling. The spotlight was working mostly just us. I caught glimpses of the four or five other couples, the girls jungle strong, animal-like, bucking and charging. But little Laura inspired me to drive to new heights. Her hair was all over her face. It was running sweat, and I couldn't believe her strength. The crowd was shouting and stomping. A new favorite was being discovered. There was a wall of noise around us. I felt her weakening. She was lindying like a fighter out on her feet, and we stumbled off to the sidelines. The band was still blasting. I had to half carry her. She was gasping for air. Some of the men in the band applauded, and even Duke Ellington half raised up from his piano stool and bowed. If a Showtime crowd liked your performance, when you came off you were mobbed, mauled, grasped, and pummeled like the team that's just taken the series. One bunch of the crowd swarmed Laura. They had her clear up off her feet, and I was being pounded on the back. When I caught this fine blonde's eyes, this one I never seen among the white girls that came to the Roseland Black Dances. She was eyeing me levelly. Now, at that time in Roxbury, in any black ghetto in America, to have a white woman who wasn't a known common whore was, for the average black man at least, a status symbol of the first order. And this one, standing there, eyeing me, was almost too fine to believe. Shoulder-length hair, well-built, and her clothes had cost somebody plenty. It's shameful to admit, but I'd just about forgotten Laura when she got loose from the mob and rushed up, big-eyed, and stopped. I guess she saw what there was to see in that girl's face, and mine, as we moved out to dance. I'm going to call her Sophia. She didn't dance well, at least not by Negro standards, but who cared? I could feel the staring eyes of other couples around us. We talked. I told her she was a good dancer and asked her where she'd learned. I was trying to find out why she was there. Most white women came to the black dances for reasons I know, but you seldom saw her kind around there. She had vague answers for everything. But in the space of that dance, we agreed that I would get Laura home early and rush back in a taxicab, and then she asked if I'd like to go for a drive later. I felt very lucky. Laura was home, and I was back at the Roseland in an hour flat. Sophia was waiting outside. About five blocks down, she had a low convertible. She knew where she was going. Beyond Boston, she pulled off into a side road and then off that into a deserted lane and turned off everything but the radio. For the next several months, Sophia would pick me up downtown and I'd take her to dances and to the bars around Roxbury. We drove all over. Sometimes it would be nearly daylight when she let me out in front of Ella's. I paraded her. The Negro men loved her, and she just seemed to love all Negroes. Two or three nights a week, we would go out together. Sophia admitted that she also had dates with white fellows. Just for the looks of things, she said. She swore that a white man couldn't interest her. I wondered for a long time, but I never did find out why she approached me so boldly that very first night. I always thought it was because of some earlier experience with another Negro, but I never asked, and she never said. Never ask a woman about other men. Either she'll tell you a lie, and you still won't know, or if she tells you the truth, you might not have wanted to hear it in the first place. Anyway, she seemed entranced with me. I began to see less of Shorty. When I did see him in the gang, he would jibe, "Man, I had to comb the birds out of my homeboy's head, and now he's got a Beacon Hill chick." But truly, because it was known that Shorty had schooled me, my having Sophia gave Shorty status. When I introduced her to him, she hugged him like a sister, and it just about finished Shorty off. His best had been white prostitutes and a few of those poor specimens that worked around in the mills and had discovered Negroes. It was when I began to be seen around town with Sophia that I really began to mature into some real status in black downtown Roxbury. Up to then, I'd been just another among all of the conked and zooted youngsters. But now, with the best-looking white woman who ever walked in those bars and clubs, and with her giving me the money I spent, too, even the big, important black hustlers and smart boys, the club managers, name gamblers, numbers bankers, and others were clapping me on the back, setting us up to drinks at special tables and calling me Red. Of course I knew their reason, like I knew my own name. They wanted to steal my fine white woman away from me. In the ghetto, as in suburbia, it's the same status struggle to stand out in some envied way from the rest. At 16... I didn't have the money to buy a Cadillac, but she had her own fine rubber, as we called a car in those days, and I had her, which was even better. Laura never again came to the drugstore as long as I continued to work there. The next time I saw her, she was a wreck of a woman, notorious around Black Roxbury, in and out of jail. She had finished high school, but by then she was already going the wrong way. Defying her grandmother, she'd started going out late and drinking liquor. This led to dope, and that to selling herself to men. Learning to hate the men who bought her, she also became a lesbian. One of the shames I've carried for years is that I blame myself for all of this. To have treated her as I did for a white woman made the blow doubly heavy. The only excuse I can offer is that, like so many of my black brothers today, I was just deaf, dumb, and blind. In any case, it wasn't long after I met Sophia that Ella found out about it, and watching from the windows one early morning, saw me getting out of Sophia's car. Not surprisingly, Ella began treating me like a viper. About then, Shorty's cousin finally moved in with the woman he was so crazy about, and Sophia financed me to take over half of the apartment with Shorty, and I quit the drugstore and soon found a new job. I became a busboy at the Parker House in Boston. I wore a starched white jacket out in the dining room where the waiters would put their customers' dirty plates and silver on big aluminum trays, which I would take back to the kitchen's dishwashers. A few weeks later, one Sunday morning, I ran into work expecting to get fired. I was so late. But the whole kitchen crew was too excited and upset to notice. Japanese planes had just bombed a place called Pearl Harbor. Chapter 5. Harlemite. Get your good ham and cheese, sandwiches, coffee, candy, cake, ice cream. Rocking along the tracks every other day for 4 hours between Boston and New York in the coach aisles of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford's Yankee Clipper. Old man Roundtree, an elderly Pullman porter and a friend of Ella's, had recommended the railroad job for me. He had told her the war was snatching away railroad men so fast that if I could pass for 21, he could get me on. Ella wanted to get me out of Boston and away from Sophia. She would have loved nothing better than to have seen me like one of those Negroes who were already thronging Roxbury in the Army's khaki and thick shoes, home on leave from boot camp. But my age of 16 stopped that. I went along with the railroad job for my own reasons. For a long time I'd wanted to visit New York City. Since I'd been in Roxbury, I'd heard a lot about the Big Apple, as it was called by the well-traveled musicians, merchant mariners, salesmen, chauffeurs for white families, and various kinds of hustlers I ran into. Even as far back as Lansing, I'd been hearing about how fabulous New York was, and especially Harlem. In fact, my father described Harlem with pride and showed us pictures of the huge parades by the Harlem followers of Marcus Garvey. And every time Joe Louis won a fight against a white opponent, big front-page pictures in the Negro newspapers such as the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, and the Afro-American showed a sea of Harlem Negroes cheering and waving, and the brown bomber waving back at them from the balcony of Harlem's Teresa Hotel. Everything I'd ever heard about New York City was exciting. Things like Broadway's bright lights and the Savoy Ballroom and Apollo Theater in Harlem, where great bands played and famous songs and dance steps and Negro stars originated. But you couldn't just pick up and go to visit New York from Lansing or Boston or anywhere else. Not without money. So I'd never really given too much thought to getting to New York until the free way to travel there came in the form of Ella's talk with old man Roundtree, who was a member of Ella's church. What Ella didn't know, of course, was that I would continue to see Sophia. Sophia could get away only a few nights a week. She said when I told her about the train job that she'd get away every night I got back into Boston, and this would mean every other night, if I got the run I wanted. Sophia didn't want me to leave at all, but she believed I was draft age already, and thought the train job would keep me out of the army. Shorty thought it would be a great chance for me. He was worried sick himself about the draft call that he knew was soon to come. Like hundreds of the black ghetto's young men, he was taking some stuff that, it was said, would make your heart sound defective to the draft board's doctors. Shorty felt about the war the same way I and most ghetto Negroes did. Whitey owns everything. He wants us to go and bleed for him? Let him fight. Anyway, at the railroad personnel hiring office down on Dover Street, a tired-acting old white clerk got down to the crucial point when I came to sign up. Age, little? When I told him 21, he never lifted his eyes from his pencil. I knew I had the job. I was promised the first available Boston to New York fourth cook job, but for a while I worked there in the Dover Street yard helping to load food requisitions onto the trains. Fourth cook, I knew, was just a glorified name for dishwasher. But it wouldn't be my first time, and just as long as I traveled where I wanted, it didn't make any difference to me. Temporarily, though, they put me on the Colonial that ran to Washington, D.C. The kitchen crew, headed by a West Indian chef named Duke Vaughn, worked with almost unbelievable efficiency in the cramped quarters. against the sound of the train clacking along, the waiters were jabbering the customers' orders, the cooks operated like machines, and 500 miles of dirty pots and dishes and silverware rattled back to me. Then on the overnight layover, I naturally went sightseeing in downtown Washington. I was astounded to find in the nation's capital, just a few blocks from Capitol Hill, thousands of Negroes living worse than any I'd ever seen in the poorest sections of Roxbury, in dirt floor shacks along unspeakably filthy lanes with names like Pig Alley and Goat Alley. I'd seen a lot, but never such a dense concentration of stumble bums, pushers, hookers, public crapshooters, even little kids running around at midnight begging for pennies, half naked and barefooted. Some of the railroad cooks and waiters had told me to be very careful because muggings, knifings, and robberies went on every night among these Negroes. Just a few blocks from the White House. End of side 2.